Hello and welcome. This is an audio recording of an IFG live event.
Good morning and welcome to this IFG live event. Brexit, what next? What is the future of the UK-EU relationship in 2021? Now you'll notice that unfortunately Jill Rutter, our senior fellow, isn't available to join us this morning. Some tech problems. We're trying out new technology and unfortunately she hasn't been able to join. So instead you'll have me, Maddie Teamwood-Jack, Associate Director at the Institute for Government, stepping into the hot seat. The trade and cooperation agreement between the UK and the EU was agreed on Christmas Eve. We saw the text on Boxing Day, and there were just a few days for those of us sort of watchers, but also businesses to try and get the head around the details of the deal. You'll have seen that the IFG produced an explainer. Lots of other experts also produced lots of analysis of the deal. But we're here now to sort of discuss both, a few weeks into January, what are our reflections on the agreement that has been reached, but also how is it unfolding on the ground? How are businesses adjusting to the terms of this agreement? And then if we sort of take a bit of a step back and also think about sort of what is the future direction of travel for the relationship between the UK and the EU. So to discuss all of these questions, I am very, very pleased to be joined by both Joe Marshall and Jess Sargent, senior researchers on the Brexit team, but also Professor Anna Menon from the UK Interchanging Europe, one of our sort of our friends of the IFG. So very, very pleased that you can join us this morning to talk about all of this. So I think, Anna, I'll come to you first. Just sort of what are your reflections? You know, have your views of the deal changed now that there have been a few more weeks to try and get your head around it? Do you think, you know, the UK sort of got what it wanted?
I think it's always worth just pausing and thinking how different it would have been with no deal at all. And I think, you know, that's something I think we forget in the middle of sort of criticising the deal, which is easy to do, and I'll come on to. It's still quite impressive that both sides managed to get a deal, and it looked to me in early December like they wouldn't. So that's the first thing I'd say. The thing that's really sort of caught my attention the more I think about this deal is the degree to which it is obviously drafted as the first stage of a relationship that will evolve. The organic nature of what's on paper is really striking to me the more I think about it. Now, whether that reflects the desire of both sides or not, we'll see, because I'm slightly surprised in a way that the British government signed up to something that's so obviously meant to evolve. But we'll see. I mean, there's a process here, and this is far more Swiss-like than I thought would have been the case, I have to say. That's where I was completely wrong. I didn't think the European Union would sign up to a deal that involved so much future negotiating. Did the British government get what it wanted? Yes, I think, because the British government didn't really focus at all on the economics here. The focus was, as David Frost made clear almost a year ago in Brussels, on taking back control, on regulatory autonomy, and they've managed to secure that to a significant extent, I think.
I will come back to you in a second, but I should have said, sorry, please do send in your questions. Please reply to the video and do send in your questions, and I will try and put them to the panelists. Sorry, as I said, last minute chairing means I forgot some of my chairing duties. But thanks, Anna, for those thoughts. I mean, you've mentioned the fact that you were surprised that the EU signed up to the sort of you know, there are obviously a lot of working groups, joint committees, there's a lot still to be figured out. I mean, do you think then the EU is going to be happy with what has been negotiated?
I think the EU will be relieved that the process is over, first and foremost. I think, you know, a number of member states had moved on from Brexit well before the deal was signed in December. I think they will feel happy that they've A, maintained their unity, and B, maintained what they portrayed as a matter of principle, which is, you know, maintaining the unity of the single market. I think, you know, as Michel Barnier keeps saying, they'd have liked a broader agreement. They'd have liked more on foreign policy. So I don't think this is perfect. But in terms of their defensive asks, I think that's the case for both sides. Both sides attained their defensive asks. Both sides actually didn't press very hard at all on their more offensive asks, which is something we might talk about. Because I'm not sure this this treaty creates the basis for a strategic relationship for the next 30 or 40 years. I think it's going to have to be revisited at some point, just because we collaborate in so many issues and we share so many interests in common on so many things that aren't covered by this treaty. But defensively, both sides will be relatively happy, yes.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you in the sense that it's sort of going to be interesting to see how the direction of travel goes. And as you say, the sort of defence of us might have been sort of won here. But there is a question about whether in some areas they will want to revisit and build on the agreement. And obviously, there's a question about future governments of the UK that also who also might want to revisit aspects of the agreement. Joe, if I can bring you in here now. You know, there was a lot of, before the end of the year, there were lots of discussion about, are we going to be seeing queues of trucks up the M20 at Manson Airport? We obviously had a bit of a preview before Christmas when France closed the border. I mean, are you surprised that we haven't sort of seen more of that? And I will acknowledge that obviously one of the big industries that we know has been sort of concerned or have been hit quite hard by the deal so far is the Scottish seafood industry. Maybe we can come back to that. But more broadly, what's your sort of analysis of what's going on the ground?
Thanks, Maddie. I think basically, we shouldn't get confused about the sort of visible disruption, visible changes and the things that are less visible but are clearly going on across the country. And we shouldn't underestimate the sort of scale of the changes that businesses are having to adapt to in a very short time frame. So lots of complex new rules, you know, customs checks, regulatory checks, new paperwork, duplicate regimes in the UK and the EU. And we've known since we knew the UK was leading the single market and the customs union, that many of these sort of big structural changes in how trade between the UK and the EU, particularly Great Britain and the EU, works were coming. But that is very different from seeing it in practice, understanding the detail. And we've seen that, you know, many businesses, 150,000 or so registered with HMRC for VAT, had only ever traded with the EU before internationally and had never had to deal with these sorts of things. And so they're dealing with this for the first time. And even, you know, large, well-prepared businesses have found that some of the new regulation changes, some of the new complex rules have taken them by surprise. And we've seen that particularly around firms that use Great Britain as a distribution hub for the EU, who are finding that, you know, rules about how you access tariff-free access to the single market are proving more difficult than they expected. And ultimately, firms finding that, you know, a free trade agreement does not deliver frictionless trade, and there is still a lot of friction there. I mean, as you said, so far we've not seen those sort of huge queues of lorries at the ports comparable to the things we saw before Christmas when the border was closed due to COVID. And at the liaison committee last week, the Prime Minister seemed to chalk that up as a success. You're saying it was remarkable, we hadn't seen that. But actually, I think when we look across the country and you look down supply chains, there is a lot of disruption happening, sometimes behind the scenes and sometimes, like you said, with the Scottish seafood industry, more visible. So we've seen, you know, many firms stopping trading or suspending trading with the EU until they can make sense of new rules. And I should say as well, it's not just British firms trading with the EU, but firms in Great Britain trading with Northern Ireland, who are also facing new changes as a result of the Northern Ireland Protocol, which also came into effect at the end of last year. So firms, you know, stopping trading. We've had some hiccups with IT systems and new processes. This is less that the government IT systems at the border aren't working, but more that, you know, people are getting confused about what they need to input into those systems. Some of the private sector software that many companies rely on to communicate with those government IT systems are struggling, in large part because many of the government IT systems were delivered late in the day. And we've also had, you know, long delays getting paperwork done at some of the inland border sites and customs paperwork completed. And we've also got, you know, some firms that really want to trade with the EU struggling to do so because the hauliers they rely on to pick up their goods are refusing to take goods because they're concerned that paperwork isn't in order and they're concerned their lorries will get stuck at customs. Or hauliers who are refusing to take mixed loads of goods on one lorry from lots of different businesses because that duplicates paperwork, creates a lot of complexity and again increases the risk of disruption. We've also got confusion in supply chains about who is responsible for certain bits of paperwork and new requirements, and some of those long-trailed concerns about a shortage of customs agents to help businesses complete new customs paperwork and of vets to sign off export health certificates needed for agri-food goods. And I think you're right, Maddie, to say that, you know, some of those issues have really, you know, crystallised in certain sectors in particular. And I think we've seen this in firms trading in agri-food goods, and in Scotland, the Scottish seafood industry in particular, in part because the new checks at the border on agri-food goods are particularly onerous and complicated, and also in part because of the perishable nature of the products, which means those sectors weren't able to stockpile ahead of Brexit, which allowed some other sectors a bit of leeway to get used to the new rules and not have to rely on trading quite as much straight away. Whereas, obviously, with perishable products, it's not possible to do that. And also, perishable products are very vulnerable to disruption. It doesn't take very long or very much delay in the supply chain for those products to become spoiled or unviable. And so we've seen, Scottish seafood, Scottish fishing fleet sort of tied up at port or having to land in the EU to try and get around that. And I should say, some of these issues will be short term. They are about people getting used to the new rules. They are a bit more like teething problems. But others will be longer term. Businesses are going to be looking at their business models and their supply chains and thinking, does what we had pre-Brexit continue to work post-Brexit? Give them a new cost, give them a new friction, give them a new time it takes to trade with between Great Britain and the EU and Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And over the next few months and years, we will see firms starting to adapt, potentially no longer serving the EU market or Northern Ireland market, potentially changing their supply chains. EU firms or Northern Ireland firms that buy from companies in Great Britain potentially saying, actually, we're going to buy from the EU or Northern Ireland because these firms don't have to comply with these requirements and they're less vulnerable to disruption. So we will see that playing out, and it will be a complicated picture across different sectors, between businesses, and the picture complicated further by COVID, which obviously makes it hard to disentangle exactly what's going on and where disruption is coming from. So basically, I would say we have seen a lot of disruption. It's biting in lots of different places, not always visible, but up and down the country, companies and firms are having to grapple with huge changes with very little time to prepare and in a very difficult economic environment.
That's super helpful. And I think you've sort of sketched out sort of a number of different issues that firms are grappling with. And I do think it's definitely worth pointing out that not all of this is happening at the border. I do think the point about COVID is really, really interesting because we know sort of trade flows are reduced at the moment. And we also know people aren't going abroad at the moment. So we're not seeing some of those issues. Now, my flatmate is a vet. As you guys know, I talk about her quite a lot. And she hasn't had to do lots and lots of animal health certificates yet for pets going abroad. But she is preparing herself, I think, for the summer as restrictions might ease. So I do think the sort of impact of COVID in terms of disguising some of these new challenges, particularly for those delivering services, is sort of worth exploring. But that's really, really helpful. Joe, now you mentioned Northern Ireland and sort of trade between GB and Northern Ireland. Jess, I'm going to come to you on this, our resident expert on the Northern Ireland Protocol. Now, Brandon Lewis this morning was saying that actually most of the impacts we're seeing on the supermarket shelves in Northern Ireland as a result of COVID rather than Brexit. Do you agree with him?
I think certainly in the case of those empty shelves that we see in Northern Ireland supermarkets, it is difficult to determine exactly what is causing that. I would disagree with the Secretary of State when he says it's nothing to do with Brexit and the Northern Ireland Protocol. But clearly there are other issues, both in terms of kind of COVID supply chains, but also just the fact that the Northern Ireland is at the end of the UK-wide supply chain. So any disruption created on GBEU trade will have knock-on implications for Northern Ireland. But I think we have also seen a number of other issues that you can attribute directly to the Northern Ireland Protocol. So as well as kind of problems with food availability, what we've seen is a lot of supermarkets in Northern Ireland streamline their product ranges, so temporarily suspend a lot of their products. So we've seen, we've heard about Percy Pigs and the problems in the Republic of Ireland. We've seen some other, Walter the Sausage Dog, Easter egg being withdrawn from Northern Ireland and similar things there. I think what we've also seen places like Sainsbury's substitute some of their products for local products. So they're selling some spa products. So it's definitely, I think there are clear knock-on implications of the protocol there. I think the other thing we've seen is some GB businesses pull out of Northern Ireland temporarily altogether, just because they're not clear how they can comply with the protocol. A lot of the guidance that was given by the government really came at a very late stage. So thinking here particularly about the guidance for parcels, that only came 12 hours before it was due to be complied with, so on the 31st of December, which meant that a lot of people, consumers in Northern Ireland, were having trouble getting things delivered there. You know, real world impacts on people in Northern Ireland. Now, we've seen some of those couriers return to business in Northern Ireland, so it's not clear how long term that would be. But we're also hearing reports of things like increased delivery costs or higher maximum spends. So I think there are some longer term changes here that will come about. And we've also seen some disruption at the border itself, even though obviously the government insists that that's not a border. There are certainly the need for new paperwork and checks, and there has been some confusion there about what exactly traders between Great Britain and Northern Ireland need to provide. And in some cases, there has been more problems, it seems, in terms of compliance there than at the GB-EU border. But I think really the thing to say is that actually a lot of the changes, and potentially the most potentially disruptive changes that will take place on GBNI trade, haven't even happened yet. So back in December, the UK and the EU agreed a 3-month grace period for export health certificates. So that's the special piece of paperwork that you will need to transport agri-food products between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And there is where you have the most extensive checks. I mean, it's not clear exactly how frequent those will be, but it could be that up to kind of 30% of certain products need to be physically inspected by a vet when they arrive in Northern Ireland. We also knew that the facilities to conduct those checks were absolutely not ready. There'd been big delays in terms of the Northern Ireland executive building that infrastructure and getting ready to conduct those checks. 3 months isn't a huge amount of time. And the major supermarkets wrote a joint letter to Michael Gove recently saying that unless there are further mitigations or kind of an extension to that grace period, then their supply chains could become completely unworkable. So certainly I think we've seen some disruption on GBNI trade, but I think there is more to come. And I think the government's going to have to work, both the UK government and the Northern Ireland Executive are going to have to work very hard in the next 3 months to try and mitigate some of those problems and prevent more disruption further down the line.
Is there anything they can do in April? So, you know, obviously the grace period ends at the end of March. I mean, will there be sort of an attempt to try and sort of buy more time? I mean, how is government, do we know how government is preparing to try and manage that? Is there some sort of agreement they could reach with the EU? Or given what we've seen in the TCA, is this sort of all sort of final now? This is, we know that the grace period is coming to an end. We know that there are going to be SPS, full SPS checks, and that's sort of all there is to it. I mean, do you have a view as to what more might be done in April?
So I think the UK government's plan is certainly to try and agree further mitigations with the EU, whether that be some kind of long-term trusted trader scheme that will remove the need for certain checks or paperwork on things like major supermarkets, or whether that's just buying more time. Certainly, I think that's the UK government's intention. But it's not clear whether the EU will agree to that. I mean, almost as soon as we saw these grace periods been agreed, we were hearing slightly different things about what that grace period was for. So if you listen to the UK government, they would say that, you know, this grace period is to allow more time to negotiate a longer term solution to some of these issues. But from EU sources, we were hearing that this grace period was to allow suppliers to adjust to the checks that definitely would be coming into force in 3 months' time. So I think there is a lot of discussions that will need to be had between the UK and the EU. It's not really clear at this point to what extent they are still talking, whether those whether the specialised committee, which is responsible for looking at some of these issues, and the joint committee are still meeting, and on what on how regular a basis they are meeting. And I think we have the risk again that even if there are decisions, that these could come really late in the day. These could come, you know, a couple of weeks, if, you know, maybe that's even good timing, if it's a couple of weeks, a couple of days, perhaps, if we base it on some of the decisions we've seen recently, before the changes are due to come into effect. And that itself will cause disruption. So I think, yeah, the UK government is hoping it can agree some mitigations. We'll have to see whether that's the case. I think the other things it really needs to prioritise is stepping up some of these schemes that it's put in place to support traders that trade across the Irish Sea. So in terms of the agri-food industry, there's the movement assistance scheme, which will cover the costs of this new agri-food paperwork. They need to make sure that that's fully up and running and ready to deal with the quantity and the scale of the business it's going to need to serve. And the other thing is also the Northern Ireland Executive, with the support of the UK government, really needs to make a lot of progress on the facilities for those checks and making sure those are ready. The Permanent Secretary of the Department of Agriculture in Northern Ireland had been very candid and honest at the end of last year that those facilities just weren't ready. Their work had really barely been started. So I think they need to be working on the assumption that the full range of checks and requirements will be in place in the beginning of April and make sure it makes lots of progress.
Great. So still a lot of change to come. Anna, I'm going to bring you in now. You know, we've obviously heard from both Joe and Jess about a lot of the disruption that that sort of happened. I mean, one of the other areas, sort of one of the more high profile issues that we've heard about is about the creative industries and musicians, for example, traveling musicians who will no longer be able to move freely within the EU delivering their service or performing. This is obviously one area that's got a lot of attention. I mean, is this something, you know, are there going to be ways that the UK and EU can build on this agreement? Do you feel like that's sort of relatively straightforward? Do you think as these teething problems arise, there will be an appetite for both sides to actually try and address some of these issues?
It's not clear to me whether there will be that appetite, firstly, on the side of the British government. I'm not sure this is a British government that is going to say, OK, we should have thought about this. We should have negotiated this. We're going to go back to the negotiating table. I think this government wants this out of the way and behind it and wants to sell this deal as a success. And on the EU side, I mean, remember, the British were entered these talks with a certain number of asks, particularly around visas for service providers, and the EU were reluctant to give that. So I'm not convinced that the EU is going to want to do us any favours. Now, it might be that the EU approach is phased. That is to say, there are some member states who clearly see Brexit as an opportunity to attract businesses previously based in the UK to them. You see a little bit of that in the financial services. You see a bit of that in life sciences. But it might be, I suppose, over time, when we get to the point where all those firms that might have been willing to go have gone, that the EU thinks, OK, at this point, we need to make the best of what we've got and start to change things. There is always that flexibility to add to this deal going forward. I just am very, very sceptical that anything's going to happen in the near term because of unwillingness on both sides, to be honest.
So related to that, John Pete has put in a question asking about whether sort of now there's a deal that's been done, will the EU actually have the appetite to agree equivalence for financial services or adequacy for data? You know, aren't they keen to sort of try and make sure that their competitor doesn't have the advantages that those sorts of decisions might confer? I mean, Anna, what's your view on that?
I'm not sure it's a question of appetite, John, but I certainly think there are issues here. I mean, I for one think that whenever the Chancellor stands up and says we're going to change the regulations around financial services in such a way as to make the city the best place in the world to list your company on the stock market, people in the EU are listening and thinking, well, if they're going to play regulatory games, it gives us an incentive not to offer them equivalence. And I think the same with data. If we end up signing trade deals with other countries with fairly liberal provisions for data, it will make the EU think twice about granting us data adequacy. So I think the EU are going to watch what we're doing and what we're saying. And it's far from a foregone conclusion, particularly when it comes to equivalence, I think, that they're going to be very generous at all.
That's interesting. And I mean, thanks everyone who's sending in lots of comments on YouTube. And I think there was a question about some of the sort of some of the things we've been hearing in the press about deregulation and what the UK government might do with its newfound freedom. And I'm going to stick with you. I'm intrigued as to whether you think, you know, there are sort of two aspects of this. There's obviously the sort of domestic appetite for deregulation, but there's also the fact that the UK government has signed up to certain provisions in the TCA to say that there won't be any regression on, for example, labour and environmental standards. Mm-hmm. But sort of there's an interesting question about, you know, do you think that the EU is going to be, you know, looking to initiate some of these disputes? Do you think it will be handled in a different way? Do you think we'll get that far? I mean, how do you sort of view some of these sorts of the provisions in the TCA in terms of sort of tying the government's hands sort of over the next, you know, however many years?
Well, firstly, I'm not convinced the government is going to do this, and that's going to depend on politics. But let's assume they do. It's hard to know on the EU side. Jill and I wrote a piece a while back in which we argued that the EU sort of paradoxically undervalued its own single market, in the sense that they sort of underestimated the degree to which being inside the single market confers real benefits on firms. And the flip side of that is they underestimate what the costs of entry are for firms outside of the single market. And I think it is soon going to become clear to the European Union that the simple fact of being outside the European Union has a crippling effect on many British businesses, and that simply by deregulating, whether it's workers' rights or something like that, is not suddenly going to give those firms a massive competitive advantage because of those entry costs. So I think given that, I wonder whether the EU is going to risk the kind of standoff with the UK that triggering those clauses would mean if they calculate that on balance, actually, market access is difficult enough that this won't make a real difference to them.
Interesting. Joe, I might bring you in now. As you'll be aware, we at the IFG are obviously very interested in terms of sort of how the government sets itself up to actually manage this relationship, because, you know, Anna's obviously just said that we don't know whether the EU will be jumping to trigger some of those retaliatory mechanisms if the UK does things differently. But however much this government or, you know, the ministers might want to say it's all sorted, we don't have to worry about the EU anymore, I think we can all agree that the relationship with the EU is going to remain incredibly important. And so, I mean, from your perspective, what is sort of your view in terms of how the government should be thinking about this relationship?
Thanks, Maddie. I mean, I think, yeah, everything you were saying and things that Alan have said are really important issues to be thinking about. You know, the relationship with the EU, you know, set out in the Trade and Cooperation Agreement and the other Brexit agreements we've got, Jeff was talking about, you know, around Northern Ireland Protocol as well, basically do set out this really complicated set of mechanisms for future discussion, for reviewing bits of the agreement. So we know there are 19 specialised committees, 4 working groups set out in the Trade and Cooperation Agreement alone. And I think, you know, as much as the UK government and the current UK government might want to sort of put Brexit behind it and focus on different things, sort of own the narrative that Brexit is done, I think the reality is that, you know, the UK's relationship with the EU as an EU member took up a huge amount of bandwidth in Whitehall, and the UK's relationship with the EU outside the EU is going to take up a lot of bandwidth. And I think there are lots of big questions the government needs to think about in terms of how it manages that relationship with the EU and how, you know, who in Whitehall is responsible for it. So, you know, there are lots of different working groups, you know, and very specialised committees in different sectors looking after different parts of the agreement and working out, you know, which government departments or agencies feed into those groups and how they're, you know, responsible for them is a big question. And then the sort of strategic question of how do you across the board keep track of this relationship? How do you keep tabs on all these discussions that are going on? How do you make sure you have a sense of the sort of general direction of the relationship? You have a way of feeding in the government sort of strategic objectives of what it wants to get out of that relationship to the extent that it has those or elaborates on those, and where that should sit in government. Should it be with the Department for International Trade, who like to think, you know, they own these sort of trading relationships? Should it be with Cabinet Office, which is quite often a sort of IFG recommendation that things are just in the centre of government where you've got a good oversight? Should it be elsewhere? You know, there's lots of these questions to consider. And you know, it is also important, this sort of question, the extent to which the government polices what the rest of government and departments are doing in their policy areas. Because as we say, actually, when you look at the constraints on government, you know, lots of, in theory, lots of things that the government has more control over now, lots of policy levers it can pull that formerly sort of sat with the EU. But actually, when we look in reality, when you look at the terms of the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, when you look at the terms of the Northern Ireland Protocol, domestic public opinion, the fact that businesses will want in many cases want to continue quite close alignment with single market rules in order to make trade with the EU easier. All of these constraints mean that actually the government's room for manoeuvre might be quite limited. And how the government puts in place processes across Whitehall to try and sort of police that, to make sure that the UK isn't falling foul of its obligations, isn't, you know, trying to do things that it can't do, is another big question. And I think that is partly a political question, because, you know, I don't think many ministers who, you know, want to take back control will be particularly happy to then have to start thinking about all of these constraints day to day, and also about how you make the civil service think about some of those things. Because, you know, we've heard, you know, often the civil service can be quite sort of risk averse when thinking about these things, and it's a balance there between wanting to make sure those constraints are taken into consideration, but also ensuring that where the government legitimately wants to do things differently and has the scope to do things differently, it is able to do so, and civil service can adapt in a way that facilitates that rather than stands in the way. So I think basically, you know, we have this very complicated relationship with the EU that has been set out in the Trade and Cooperation Agreement and other agreements. But how Whitehall as a machine manages the different aspects of that, and how someone in Whitehall has a sense of what's going on across the board, a lot of unanswered questions there, but things the government needs to think about and start thinking about quite quickly, given, you know, for certain deadlines for conversations to carry on and for these sort of working groups and things to be set up, will start kicking in quite quickly.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, I mean, there's already discussion about needing to have the Partnership Council up and running so that they can take a decision on extending the period of time for the European Parliament to scrutinise the agreement and sort of complete ratification on the EU side. So it's quite interesting to see. I think that'll be a first indication possibly of where responsibility might sit, because it should be a UK minister being represented. And so there's a question, will it be Michael Gove, as he represents the UK on the Joint Committee, and therefore a sort of suggestion that Cabinet Office might remain in charge of the EU relationship as it did previously, or will we see Dominic Raab possibly stepping up and an indication it might move over to the Foreign Office or Foreign SCDO? I think, just very briefly, I saw there was a comment asking about parliamentary scrutiny of all of this, and that will be very important. And we have obviously seen the government decide to sort of end the standing orders, sort of, or at least allow the standing orders of the Future Relationship Committee in the House of Commons to lapse. And there is an event we are holding on Friday that will be asking this exact question of what is the future of parliamentary scrutiny. But I want to come sort of pick up on something that Jo's also just mentioned and get your view, Jess, on the sort of Northern Ireland point, because this is what's really interesting, is that, you know, in the future, the GB may choose to diverge in certain ways from EU rules, but we do know that in some areas anyway, EU rules will continue to apply to Northern Ireland. And I wonder what your view is on that in terms of, you know, how should the government be thinking about it, but also what sort of, what then does that mean for the relationship that the UK government might need to have with the EU?
Yeah, I think it's a really important question, and I think one that so far has been underexplored in the UK government itself. So the UK government obviously wants to take advantage of some of the opportunities presented by Brexit in terms of perhaps making most of these new regulatory freedoms, as Joe was asking. But it also has made it very clear that one of its aims is to protect the integrity of the UK internal market. So to ensure that there are no unnecessary trade barriers between each part of the UK. I mean, you can argue slightly that the protocol itself perhaps to some extent undermines that aim, but certainly there is the potential, if GB and Northern Ireland diverge even further, that as well as those kind of checks and paperwork that's required, we might see more friction in the UK internal market if Northern Ireland has different standards than the rest of Great Britain. So there's a couple of programmes that are designed to manage this. We've seen the passage of the UK Internal Market Act just before Christmas. That's slightly asymmetric in its application, in that it will guarantee qualifying Northern Ireland goods access to GB, but the same cannot be true the other way round. So there is no guarantee that goods produced in Scotland, Wales or Northern Ireland will be able to be sold in Northern Ireland where there are obligations to comply with EU law. They will still need to meet that. There's also another programme of work going on, which is Common Frameworks, which is where the four governments are attempting to agree processes to manage divergence in areas of retained EU law. So that one's kind of more more slightly by consensus rather than a kind of hard and fast principle that will guarantee market access. The common frameworks are really about looking at potential for regulatory divergence, discussing that, thinking through that, trying to find the best way to mitigate that. And I think certainly that will work in a sense if the Scottish Government wants to propose a new regulation, that can be discussed. They can think about how best to implement that change in a way that is least disruptive for the UK internal market. But it's a slightly different case in Northern Ireland, because Northern Ireland will be under an obligation to apply that EU law. It won't have the discretion to decide whether or not it will apply EU law in areas that are specified in the annexes in the protocol, although it might have a little bit of discretion to decide how in the case of kind of EU directives. But I think what that will then do is it will raise questions of how the rest of the UK, how Great Britain should respond to changes of EU law that are applicable in Northern Ireland, and whether the intention is still going to be to have harmonisation across the UK, or whether it's going to be acceptable to just have harmonisation across GB and have Northern Ireland as a slight kind of outlier. So I think there are, and all these programmes, like Joe was saying, are also being done separately. There's a single kind of department that's responsible and has oversight of the UK Internal Market Act, of common frameworks, and of the Northern Ireland Protocol. So I think it's really important that so far as possible things are kind of very closely integrated, and also that the UK government has kind of systematic mechanisms for monitoring EU law for a range of reasons, but I think more than anything so it is aware of changes that will affect Northern Ireland and might have knock-on implications for the UK internal market.
Jess, can I just ask a slightly sort of cynical question, which is, is it in the interest of the Scottish government to make sure the common frameworks conversations fail?
That's an interesting question. I mean, certainly the Scottish Government have made absolutely no secret of the fact that they are incredibly opposed to the UK Internal Market Act. They will not participate in that programme. But we haven't actually seen that behaviour in terms of common frameworks. Those, from what we're hearing, are still going very well. I think in some cases, you know, there is the incentive for the Scottish Government to make the case that the UK Government is acting unreasonably and not respecting the Scottish Government, because obviously that could further their ultimate aim of independence. But equally, there is no guarantee that there is going to be a second independence referendum, let alone independence. And actually, in my mind, common frameworks is the answer to some of those concerns about the potentially kind of deregulatory pressures that are created by the UK Internal Market Act. So what the UK Internal Market Act, it doesn't prevent divergence between the four nations, it just guarantees market access in the event that divergence arises. So it could prevent, for example, if the Scottish Government wanted to ban chlorinated chicken, then if England didn't ban it, then chlorinated chicken would have to be produced in England or imported into England, would have to be acceptable in Scotland. So it could undermine some of their policy objectives. But if they were able, through a common framework, to agree a certain standard that would prevent chlorinated chicken, then that could kind of slightly resolve the problem. So I think there are incentives for the Scottish Government to continue to engage in this particular work programme. But we will have to see kind of how, whether the politics does end up getting in the way as time goes on, really.
Can I also ask a follow-up question on the thing I'm sort of interested in is your view on the Northern Ireland Assembly vote in 4 years' time? Well, is it 3 years' time? 2024, anyway, I guess probably about 4 years, given we're only in January now. But, you know, you've written before about the fact that actually making the protocol work is sort of both in the interest of the UK government, but also in the interest of the EU. I mean, how do you think that might then play out in terms of sort of the sort of implementation and application of the protocol over the next few years?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the UK government has a tendency to perhaps use the consent vote as a bit of a threat to the EU, to say if you don't make this work well, then there is the risk that it could be rejected. I think, you know, that is a fair argument. I think that does give the EU an incentive to act reasonably and proportionately in the kind of checks and controls that are applied on trade between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. But I think it's important that this isn't seen as it. Like, the protocol was agreed. It was agreed quite quickly. I think over this last year, we've had some discussions about some of the problems that might be unintended consequences, perhaps even, that might be created by that slightly rushed negotiation of the protocol. And I think we'll only really see how it operates in practice. Like, certain issues will only come to light once it's been enforced for a certain amount of time. So I think it is important for the UK and the EU to continue to discuss how the protocol is operating, to make adjustments where possible and where necessary, to try and make sure that we avoid a kind of cliff edge after that consent vote in 2024. I think it's also not in the UK's interest for the Northern Ireland, for Northern Ireland Assembly to reject those elements of the protocol that are covered by the consent mechanism, because it will just create kind of more disruption and more uncertainty for Northern Ireland businesses. And ultimately, what the UK needs to do is make a success of Northern Ireland and of the Northern Ireland economy. So I think it's in the interest of both to try and make sure that this is a long-term sustainable solution that works for Northern Ireland. But as I said, there is the risk of this second cliff edge. And I think if, as we do get closer to 2024, I think we also do need to give some thought to what the alternative would be if the Northern Ireland Assembly were to reject those elements of the protocol on trade and regulation, because kind of having a vote for, you know, a complete uncertainty, potentially a hard border on the island of Ireland, isn't necessarily a very fair choice to present to the Northern Ireland Assembly. So I think there kind of needs to be a little bit more thinking about what that would look like in practice and what the alternative might be if there were to be one.
Brilliant. So still a lot to work out. And I will just add that there's been a comment on YouTube just clarifying that the Scottish Government does support the frameworks approach and considers frameworks sufficient to protect the UK/GB internal market. So I think agreeing with you there, Jess. Now, we've sort of talked quite a lot about the detail of the agreement, what it means and how it's sort of all working so far, but also some of the pitfalls ahead. We sort of talked a little bit more about a bit about the future, but if we can take a step back now, and I wanted to come to you because, you know, one of the things that I think was has been very noticeable, particularly last year, but also, you know, in the Commons debate on the agreement on the 30th of December, is the fact that Labour, Keir Starmer, is very keen not to talk about Brexit, does not want to be drawn on it. You know, he ended up obviously deciding that the party would support the deal. Now, he argued that was because the alternative would be no deal. So that was sort of why Labour ended up voting in favour of it. I mean, if we, you know, he may not want to talk about it for the next year or so, but if we are talking about an election in 2024, surely Labour will need to have some kind of policy on Europe. I mean, what's your view in terms of where you think Labour might go on some of these questions?
Well, I think it's quite clear where Labour want to go, and that's anywhere but Brexit. Labour want the political battle to be on the sort of traditional economic terrain, and they want to link that to their critique of Boris Johnson's lack of competence. That's where they want to be fighting the battle. I think they've made a mistake. I think they made a tactical mistake by placing so much emphasis on deal versus no deal in the run-up to the agreement, which meant that they actually had no ammunition to criticise what they could reasonably have said was a very thin deal that failed a lot of British businesses. But by focusing on the dangers of no deal, I think they sort of lost a possible attack line, and a useful attack line, I think, as the economic implications of Brexit continue to be apparent throughout the length of this parliament and beyond. I think what Labour should have done is formulated a narrative about a thin deal as well as a narrative about no deal. I also am sceptical as to whether Keir Starmer will manage not to talk about Brexit for several reasons. I mean, one, because as we've been discussing, this is an ongoing process, whether it's the vote coming up in Stormont or the implementation of non-regression, whatever it may be, Brexit is going to be there or thereabouts for the next few years. I think it's in the interest of the Conservatives to put it on the agenda. Because, I mean, what the Conservatives achieved last December was to pull together a coalition that, you know, the Tory vote is very, very united around the sort of values issues that Brexit encapsulates. So you might think it would be in their interest to play on those issues in the run-up to the next election. And I think with a review of the TCA due in 2026, it might be that they start talking about that. Final thing I would say, of course, is there are people within the Parliamentary Labour Party who are unhappy with this idea that we're simply not going to revisit the deal. And I suspect that on his back benches, Keir Starmer is going to face a bit of a pushback if he decides I'm simply not going to talk about this. So I wonder whether that line will hold or whether actually Labour leadership is going to have to come up with something other than we don't want to talk about this, it's now done.
And if we sort of turn to the other big party in the Commons, the Conservative Party, I mean, has this resolved the question of Europe that has plagued the party for so long? I mean, do you think, I know, again, we're talking about the fact that there's a lot still to be done, but quite a lot of that now can sort of happen slightly quieter. You know, there will be, the government will be doing a lot, but it can happen possibly more at the official level. Do you think that this has sort of resolved the question for the Conservative Party, or do you think that there will still be questions about, you know, again, where, as these issues emerge, whether there'll be pressure from businesses to try and build on the deal, or sort of when we may run into problems, we realise quite how, whether the deal is as constraining as we do or don't think it is. I mean, do you think that that's sort of resolved?
I mean, part of that will hinge on how this deal works going forward. I mean, if there's sustained and long-term disruption, I think it will become an issue and you'll hear some backbenchers becoming a little bit concerned. But I think ultimately the fights within the Conservative Party are going to be fights over economic policy, which will be partly caused by Brexit in the sense that Brexit is going to have a big impact on our economy. But I think it will be triggered first and foremost by what most economists expect to be the unemployment crisis that follows the public health crisis of COVID. And here the interesting thing is the Parliamentary Conservative Party appears to be divided between, you know, some of its newer MPs who are in favour of, for instance, maintaining the hike in universal credit, and more traditional Conservatives. I think that is where the row inside the Conservative Party will take place, rather than over Brexit per se. I think, you know, everyone's taken the oath on Brexit, haven't they? They're not going to criticise the deal or the Prime Minister's negotiation, but there are going to be issues around the implications, particularly in the economics, where I think differences will come into the open.
No, interesting. I agree with you there, I think. The sort of other question I just want to put to you sort of while you're here, as it were, is there's a very early question came in that I'm afraid I haven't got to yet, from YouTube, asking about the sort of consequences of the deal for the EU. And so, Anand, I wonder whether I can ask you to sort of speculate on that. You know, will the EU be able to just say, right, we've sorted, UK's out, look, guys, the deal isn't very good compared to being part, you know, part of the EU, and we can sort of press ahead with our agenda? Or do you think that actually there are going to be sort of implications for the EU in the long run?
Oh, there'll be all sorts of implications. I mean, the EU will be smaller, the EU will be weaker, it will not be as appealing because the UK market's not within it. It will change the balance of power within the EU in ways we can sort of speculate about but don't know for certain yet. I wouldn't want to be a euro out inside the European Union now that the UK is gone. It seems to me they're in a very, very vulnerable position. So, it'll change all kinds of things about the European Union. I don't think the sort of two extreme claims made about Brexit, that either trigger the falling apart of the European Union on the one hand, or that Brexit would trigger, you know, the move towards, now that the Bolshevik Brits were no longer around the table. I don't think either of those extremes is true, but absolutely Brexit is going to have an impact on the functioning of the European Union. And actually foreign policy is going to be a very interesting area to watch, given the new US administration as well, and particularly in terms of approaches to China, where at the moment it looks like the UK and the US are going to be quite close together, whereas the EU is going slightly a different direction.
No, that's really interesting. Actually, a question from John Charlesworth was exactly about that sort of impact of new president and China. So I think that is definitely one to watch. There are sort of quite a lot of questions have come in sort of generally in the sort of question of, you know, what is the direction of trade with the EU? You know, what sort of percentages of business, EU customers already don't want to sort of use UK suppliers, those sorts of, and also sort of, you know, is there going to be an appetite for the EU to reduce some of the customs checks? Those sorts of questions about some of the longer term direction of travel for trade. So Joe, I might put those to you. I mean, you speculated a little bit earlier about what some of the impacts might be. And, you know, we've obviously heard some, for example, some logistics firms have already said that for a period of time anyway, they don't want to be trading between, sort of moving goods between GB and the EU. I mean, from your perspective, what are the things, I guess, you know, you don't have a crystal ball, what are you looking for in terms of how this might unfold and what the impact might be?
Yeah, I think it is a really difficult question because to a large degree, this will vary significantly between sector, depending on the kind of new checks and paperwork and regulatory regimes different sectors are dealing with. It will depend on certain businesses and what their supply chains look like, how they, the commercial decisions they take, because a lot of the time, it is possible to continue doing a lot of business with the EU, but there are just new costs and complexity involved in doing it. And it will be a case of what appetite firms have, how much of their business relies on that sort of trade, to the extent to which they try and make it work or not. And it will also, I think, depend on the extent to which some of these problems really are short term or do become longer term. And again, we can't always differentiate that. I mean, there are some issues that are coming up which look like they might have longer term and quite significant impacts. So for instance, there's this problem about distribution centres in Great Britain, which is basically rests on rules of origin requirements. So basically, in order to benefit from tariff-free access to the EU market and to the UK market for EU firms, you have to comply with rules of origin requirements, which sort of really revolve around where good comes from. And that has caused a problem which seems to have come as quite a surprise to many firms that have distribution centres in Great Britain that serve the EU market, because they are importing goods quite often from the EU into Great Britain to a distribution centre. Those goods are sort of losing their EU origin, but not undergoing any processing or anything that would be required to make them have a UK origin for the purposes of the trade and cooperation agreement, which means that when they are then re-exported into the EU and distributed out to the EU, they are facing tariffs in a way which many businesses didn't foresee. And there are complicated customs ways to try and get around this by keeping goods in sort of duty suspension or transit, which basically means they never sort of formally enter and go into free circulation in Great Britain. But that might not be a feasible way of running your distribution centre, and it might not be possible to adapt in that way. And so it might be that over time, firms decide that actually these costs are not sustainable. We can't continue to take them. The delays and disruption it's causing is too much. But actually, we're going to have to set up new distribution centres in the EU to distribute to EU customers, for instance. So that could involve changes in where jobs are located. There are also these questions about whether some of these issues could be resolved between the UK and the EU if there's appetite to do that. But I think, as Anand and we've been talking about earlier, the degree to which there is the appetite to resolve some of these things is unclear, because actually it might be in the EU's interest to encourage the move of some of that distribution work to the EU. And actually, strategically, does it make sense for Great Britain to continue to be a distribution hub for the rest of the EU? And likewise, for options in future potentially to go further on reducing or streamlining some of the checks on agri-food goods at the border. But again, the question is, to what extent will there be appetite for that? And I think one thing that it's worth saying is that the longer the short-term disruption takes to sort of resolve, and the longer that firms temporarily stop doing things in order to make sense of the new rules, the more likely it is that their customers will decide to act and change. And actually, over time, you will see that things might not be able to go back to how they were before for various different reasons. So I think there are lots of things for us to be looking out for. And it will be a very complicated and messy picture for quite some time as firms try and work out what is in their best interest, what they can do about it, and ultimately, whether or not it is viable for them to continue to do things. And I think, at GBEU, there are limits to what the government can do there. This is just sort of a necessary consequence of the agreement that's been reached. Although I think, as Jess has talked about before, between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, it's a slightly different picture, where the UK government has sort of put in a lot more processes to try and support that trade and try and take on some of those costs that have been introduced for businesses. And so there is a question there about, to what extent, is there a limit to how much you're willing to, take on those costs and take on that support, and how long it will last for? So lots and lots of things for us to be thinking about in the months and years ahead.
Very briefly, I've got a question here of a question someone asked. Do you mean I will not be able to get my Prosecco? Joe?
You'll be able to get your Prosecco, but maybe it will cost a bit more, depending on how businesses adapt, I think. But you should be able to get your Prosecco, I'm sure. There's still a big market, I'm sure, for Prosecco in the UK, but supermarkets will be doing their utmost to meet.
Brilliant. Jess, I've got a final question for you, and then I'm going to put a sort of question that I know that Jill was planning to ask to all of you, given that she was unable to chair this discussion. I mean, just Jess, one of the things that we know this year is that we've got the upcoming, we expect May elections, but at least there are going to be elections in the devolved legislatures. Obviously, the big question is what happens in Scotland, and if there is, as expected, a new majority for the SNP, will there be another independence referendum? I mean, what impact do you think Brexit has or might have on those elections?
So I think there are some really interesting questions here. And I think I'm not myself a pollster, but certainly if you look at what Sir John Curtis has said, Brexit has been behind the increase in support for independence throughout the last couple of years. That move towards yes has come pretty much almost entirely from Remain voters. Now, the picture has been slightly complicated now with the intersection of COVID. But as you say, Scottish independence is polling above 50% quite consistently. And as you say, if there is a majority for the SNP in the Scottish Parliament elections, I think it's going to become a lot more difficult for the UK government to try and just simply say that there shouldn't be another independence referendum. I think it's going to have to come up with a slightly different line there. I think what is interesting is actually even some of the constituencies or the sectors that supported Brexit, like the fisheries industry, they are now facing the consequences of it. And there has been quite a lot of anger towards the UK government in that sense. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out. I think there is a big question kind of long term, whether this is a kind of short term boost for independence and whether it will sustain potentially a campaign. I think one of the big issues for the Scottish Government or the SNP in putting forward their vision for an independent Scotland will be around the Scottish Anglo border, in that if an independent Scotland rejoined the EU, I think as we've seen with the Northern Ireland Protocol, there would slightly have to be a trade-off here between frictionless trade with the EU and frictionless trade with the rest of the UK. Well, actually, it would just be England and Scotland, because if Scotland rejoined the EU, it would be able to trade freely with Northern Ireland as well. And here we kind of have the Conservative Party and the SNP arguing slightly the opposite cases to that they argued in Brexit. The question of, do you keep a close relationship with your geographically closest and most integrated trading partner, or do you forego that for other markets that might be slightly further away? So I think the dynamic here, once we really get into the debate about the issues, rather than once we move on from this question of whether or not there should be a Scottish independence referendum, get onto the issues of what an independent Scotland might look like and issues will be resolved. I think it's going to have a very interesting and slightly confusing relationship of the arguments for and against Brexit and the arguments for and against independence. So I think that's something we should be watching out for in the next year or so.
Yeah, definitely. Now, it's going to be very interesting to see how we sort of re-rehearse some of the debates we've already had. My final question to all of you before we wrap up, this was just, as I say, Jill was planning, I think, on asking all of you, is should the Prime Minister have read the deal himself? If I can go to you, Joe, to start with. Very briefly.
To be quite honest, I'm less concerned about whether he sat and read through all the 1,200 odd pages of the deal himself, word for word with a highlighter. It's more important that he actually understands the consequences of what's been agreed, the detail of what's there. And I think the worrying thing is that there have been some comments that the Prime Minister has made since the deal was signed that suggest that understanding is lacking in some areas, or at least could definitely be improved. So less worried if he's read it, more if he knows what's in it.
Anand, what about you?
I think I agree with that pretty much entirely. I mean, he's got staff who can read the deal for him, but you'd expect them to point out to him things like non-tariff barriers or the rules surrounding musicians who want to go and ply their trade in the European Union. I should also add that if Jill had been here, we'd have talked about cricket more.
That is true. I'm sorry that I haven't quite lived up to her standards in that area. And congratulations on the Is it the results of the match? This I'm not going to try and talk about cricket. Jess, do you have anything to add? I'll give you the final word.
Yeah, I mean, I would completely agree with both what Joe and Alan had said. I think the other thing is also, as well as understanding it, being honest about it, that line after the agreement was agreed, saying that there would be no new non-tariff barriers, that I think was then repeated, suggests that even if, you know, the speechwriters understood the deal, they weren't necessarily being honest about it. And I think when the government does that, it's just creating more problems for itself, because you can't resolve a problem without acknowledging it. And so I think it's really important that going forward, the UK government is in solutions mode, and that requires a certain amount of pragmatism and acceptance of what the problems are, and how they can best be mitigated.
I think that's very good advice from Jess. Brilliant. Well, thank you to all three of you for joining us this morning. And it's been great to have you on the panel. We've obviously always liked the work that the UK and Changing Europe does. It definitely helps our work as well. So nice to be able to chat with you about the deal. And thank you, everyone, for watching, for sending in questions. I'm really sorry if I didn't get to yours. Great to see so much chat going on. Please do join us. Again, there'll be more IFG live events. As I mentioned, we have got one on parliamentary scrutiny this Friday that you can already sign up for. Do read our analysis on the website. And yeah, please do join us again. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you've enjoyed this edition of IFG Live. Please do subscribe to hear more. And if you'd like to know about our upcoming events, please visit instituteforgovernment.org.uk/events.